Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the fourth series of The Human Podcast, a place to hear extraordinary human stories that celebrate the limitless potential of human beings. So often, our personal stories of tragedy and survival are left untold, hidden behind the facade of our ordinary lives. Human has been created to make them more seen, more heard, and more celebrated. Because by doing so, I think we can all feel more connected to our shared humanity. So if the world is feeling like a dark or difficult place, join us and let your heart be ignited by the fire of the human spirit. Today we are joined by a truly extraordinary person. Tree Carr is a published author and TEDx speaker who specializes in the realms of dreams, death, dying, psychedelics, altered states, and transpersonal psychology. Tree is a death doula, and she was ordained in 2021 at the Universal Life Church. She is a high priestess witch and master of Wicca. Her work as a death doula involves a truly sacred work of helping people spiritually, emotionally, existentially, and practically at the end of their lives. Tree holds a space for healing, for peace, for support and compassion during this most profound and sacred time of death and dying. So we are truly in majestic company today, Tree, and whilst we have many, many dear friends in common, and I have followed the work that you've done for a really, really long time, this is the first time that we've had proper time together. I have to also say, we tried to do this episode earlier this morning online, which has become the sort of habit because of lockdown and all the rest of it. And it was an absolute comedy of errors. Every single thing that could go wrong with technology on both ends did, to the point where the first time ever we had to abort the mission. And I just said, listen, I think this is just a sign that we need to meet and do this in person. So I've come to find Tree, and we are like rediscovering the, honestly, the lost art of doing this together, like face to face. And it is just, yeah, so I feel like it was all there for a reason. I'm so happy with all of that disruption earlier that now we're here. Anyway, so it goes without saying that, you know, the extraordinary work you do, Tree, is the consequence of an extraordinary life that you have lived. And so I can't tell you how honoured I feel to have you here, how, you know, honoured I'm sure our listeners will feel to have this time with you today. And before we get into the main conversation, I just wanted to see how you are today. How are you?
I'm really good, and I'm so grateful for your kind and encouraging words as well. So thank you. I feel like my cheeks are ready to explode with smiles. I'm like, my heart is bursting into a million pieces, which is really great. And it makes me feel really good about doing this work because it just feels so aligned with with service and just helping and, you know, being here. We're here for a very small amount of time on planet Earth. Our life is fleeting. It's beautiful, but it's fleeting. But, you know, if I could be of service in the fleeting moments of my life, like, that is what it's like, a life well lived then, you know.
Exactly.
Seriously.
Yeah. It really is. So, Tree, I wondered if we could just start our conversation today by taking us back to some of the beginning and most formative years of your life, which you say were spent living on a commune in America in the 1970s, you know, without access to sort of mainstream kind of popular culture, you know, no television or radio. And so you spent a lot of time in your childhood immersed in nature. And I've heard you describe how you think that played a very integral role in enabling you to connect more deeply to your inner world and particularly to dreams. And so I wonder, before we get into the work, you know, just exploring your work in dreams and everything else that's come from that, I wonder if you could just take us back to those early days and paint a picture of that world for us.
Yeah, so I was born in 1972, so a child of the 70s, and that was a time of great change as well, and all throughout the world. There was a lot of movements happening. There was the, you know, the civil rights movements. There was a psychedelic renaissance happening, which created a spiritual renaissance for many people as well. Big changes and shifts happening with consciousness at that time. And at that time, too, people were wanting to live in different ways. So there was a lot of communes and, of course, cults as well that were all popping up everywhere. And my formative years in a commune really defined, I feel, the way I am as a human now, as I'm older. And I think because they were in those formative years, you know, those formative years where you're really absorbing, it really helped to define my inner worlds, because part of the way that we lived there was no television and no pop culture. So there wasn't any distractions. And of course, back in the 70s, it was a lot more of an analog time. Yeah. If now that I think about it, it's like, wow, it seems like ancient history. You know, there was, of course, no home computers and not even fax machines, I don't know, at least in common households. But so this created an emphasis of spending time in nature and playing. I'm from a very musical family, everybody playing instruments and reading and drawing and painting. And I think this helped to connect me to more of a present mindfulness and being in the present moment. My dreams were as vivid or real as my waking experiences. So as a very young person, I just assumed that it was all part of the same long linear experience. So when you went to sleep at night, that, you know, that consciousness continues and carries on. So
would you be happy to describe some of those, or like a particular experience that?
I think, well, some of my earliest experiences were of lucid dreams or out-of-body experiences that just felt normal, like floating around the house or, you know, flying through space. Wow. So that felt normal.
How old are you at this point, then?
Probably under four. So, you know, I remember being three. I remember being in a nappy. I remember crawling.
Wow.
It's so weird, though, but I have such early, early memories. I remember being frustrated because I couldn't reach the countertop. Like, I was standing up and being frustrated that I wasn't big enough or tall enough to reach the countertop. So I remember being, you know, knee height of adults, and I remember having a diaper, a nappy, crawling around. I remember the mobile in my bed, like in my crib, and the wallpaper, things like that. And I always remember experiences in bed, like having these liminal threshold experiences on the cusp of sleep, observing and feeling like pure consciousness. But it's not until I was, you know, later being able to define it. I've always had a journaling practice, like dream journaling. And as a teenager, I wrote a lot of these memories down. Because I thought, wow, I can remember far back. So I remember writing them down. So I, you know, I remember these.
Tree, can you just describe for our listeners that might not be familiar what a liminal threshold moment is?
Yeah, so a liminal threshold experience happens every single night as we all fall to sleep. As we're falling into sleep, our brain waves slow down and they move from the beta brain wave of our active thinking mind into theta brain waves, which are more of the what we experience when we are in flow states, dreams, meditation. And so if you keep your consciousness aware, so if you have your focused awareness awake as your body is shifting, so it's a bit like being aware of two things at once.
So it's almost like slipping away and holding on at the same time.
Holding on your awareness.
Oh, that's so interesting.
And when you hold on your awareness, you're able to experience that liminal threshold. And what it is really is your brainwaves turning stations into a slower brainwave. So what happens is you can have these interesting, what are called hypnagogic experiences. So it's a hypnagogic threshold, the hypnagogic state, which is like that liminal threshold just before you fall into sleep. So it is a biological threshold. So there's science behind it. Right. So it's not, there's, you know, we've studied, you know, there's been studies around that. So even though mystical type experiences can happen in that threshold, it is a biological one. And so in that state, you can have experiences. You can have experiences of sacred geometry, visions, snippets of dreams that are starting to form. You can hear things, have audio hallucinations. And this is that a very interesting state for consciousness exploration. So that's usually where people disengage and go on an adventure, leave their body. This is where you can go straight into a lucid dream. And, you know, we're not taught these sort of things. But they're things that these are experiences that people have been having for thousands of years. Mm. And there's a lot of traditions that focus on those liminal threshold states for consciousness exploration, for spiritual practice, for shamanic practice. So it's been around for a really long time. But as a little kid, a lot of little kids experience it. Mm. But then it just sort of fades, or they don't talk about it, or they're not really shown what they are.
Mm. I mean, Tree, this moves very, very, segues very beautifully into talking about the work that you do with death and dying, and and that intersection between the work you do with dreams and death and dying. I wondered if you could just talk to us a little bit about what you feel the link is between the work that you do in dreams and the work that you do in supporting people in death and dying.
Yeah, so both are the great thresholds. Mm. So every night as we fall into sleep, and as I was describing about the brainwave shift and falling into sleep, it's like a mini death every night. Mm. So every single night, it's like you know, you're going into this other zone, and you could use it as a great analogy of a mini death. And so I see that as a threshold state. In a lot of practices, death, dreaming is used to prepare oneself for death, and the threshold state, being on that threshold state of awareness, is used in particularly like Tibetan dream yoga and the Buddhist traditions. Dream work, lucid dreaming, and working on those liminal states of dreaming is all preparation for the death moment.
God, that's so interesting. I didn't know, but can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so there's various practices, especially in Tibetan dream yoga, where you practice your whole life to, you know, to prepare to keep consciousness on the threshold of death and allow that consciousness just to carry on after the expiry of the body. In their tradition, to go through the bardos and to go through that journey there and on the other side. But there's a lot of, even in shamanic traditions, you know, the dream time, these are our zones or realms that your consciousness goes to that are part of maybe the great mystery of where, you know, what's beyond as well. So they're both mysterious liminal thresholds. So I love playing with both, you know, dreaming and death. But dreams are also got to have a biological function too. They're there to process our emotions, It's literally like the little cinema of the unconscious mind every night, you know, screening the best hits mm-hmm. of what's going on deep in your emotional mm-hmm. well-being. So they're there to regulate your emotions as well. But then there's also, there just seems to be a little bit more too, because your consciousness continues in sleep. So that's valid. So you can continue to have experiences in the altered state of sleep. And so it just, you know, it poses the question, does your consciousness remain and still have experiences even after your body has died as well?
Is there, I mean, because naturally, you know, once a person has died, if their body has died, even if there is a consciousness that remains for moments or minutes or how long after, I imagine I'd be interested to know, but it must be quite difficult to capture kind of those experiences because the person then will have passed through into death. So what, you know, is there any kind of literature on that or anything that, or is there anything that kind of has anyone been able to document that experience, or is it something that just I was really interesting how you describe it as, you know, a similar liminal threshold moment. And I'd just be fascinated to know more about that. And if that is what, you know, people who have nearly died, who've been brought back to life, who've described it in a similar way. I mean, I'm just absolutely fascinated.
This is the great mystery, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of people who have had NDEs, near-death experiences, and there's a lot of studies in and around that. And I had my own near-death experience as a young child of four, almost swept out to ocean, and my father saved me and brought me back. A sneaker wave came, and oh, it was really, like, really scary. But as I was being pulled out, it was, you know, really grappling to try to save my life. You know, your whole body kicks in, and I was trying to grapple onto the posts of the docks as I was being pulled really, really quickly, and I was... couldn't grapple them. I was getting all scratched up by the barnacles. And but at one point, you know, my body, everything, just it hit me. I was like, this is it. Mm. You know, I'm going to die. And it was like a real weird moment of acceptance of like, I'm going to die. And in that moment, I didn't care for myself so much as I felt great sorrow for my parents, that they were never going to find my body. And I just felt so much empathy for them and so sad for them. But I felt kind of fine in a way.
So interesting you say that. I mean, I had, when I was 24, I very, very nearly drowned on a beach in Bali. And I had exactly the same experience.
Oh,
I was pulled out by a cycle of waves on a surface beach where it literally had like a kind of, the beach, I didn't realise, kind of dropped off a ledge, like once you kind of got into the water, which is why it was such a good surface beach, because people, you know, great waves and stuff. And I went in, I was always a very confident swimmer, went in, obviously waves come in cycles, I went in at a moment when it was just a little bit more calm, and suddenly these waves came in and I was literally spun around upside down, the biggest waves I've ever seen or been in my life, and I just couldn't find which way was up or down, and I got spun around, so I just couldn't tell. And I went up to find air, and actually I was going down, and I got beaten down another wave, and I suddenly had this feeling exactly the same of, oh my God, I'm drowning, I'm dying, and this is it. And the moment at which I was fighting, I was doing all the wrong things, because you basically exhaust yourself, and that's why you drown. I was just absolutely panicking. And I suddenly had this moment of thinking, this is it, I'm dying. And I thought the person I thought was my mum. And I said, oh my God, my mum, I cannot bear what this is going to do to her. And then I basically passed out under the water, and I came to on the sand, and this woman was slapping me around the face. And all I could hear was my heart, and it was like, bang, bang. And it's like white flashing lights in my, I mean, I really was,
you
really,
were out, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It was that, oh, it was that close, and my bikini bottoms around my knees.
Oh,
I was like,
my God.
Yeah, so it's funny that we both had a similar,
you know what it's like.
But that same thing, I didn't think, oh, what me? I remember this moment, I remember going like that under the water, and I think that was just the moment which I blacked out,
yeah.
And then the water took me in. But it was just so interesting, and I didn't feel scared, I just felt so sad for my mum.
Yes.
And my dad.
Yes,
same thing. Exactly. We were four. Isn't that interesting? It's we both so had a very similar experience
in those, you know, split seconds of this kind of trauma.
Yeah,
that, you know, there is the scramble, the struggle, but then there's like this weird surrender, and then the first things that come through is the deep empathy and love for your family members. Mm. It's just so profound, and I found the experience very boundary dissolving. Like, it was not only being humbled by the power of nature, but also humbled by the power of love. It just never was, I was changed forever. It was like, I was only four, but I had a little ego death, you know, because I literally did have my life flash before my eyes, and there wasn't much to flash before my eyes at that time. But it's true when people say, like, your life flashes before your eyes. It's true. And it always comes back to love. So when my dad got me and brought me to the beach, I was absolute shock, like catatonic. Mm. And he pulled out his camera and he took a photo of me. And I was absolutely just in shock. And I just remember thinking, why is he taking a photo of me? And like, so this photo of me was always in the family album. And as an older, like a teenager, I asked him, I was like, why did you take that photo of me that day? I was like, you know, almost drowned. And he said, because your eyes really, they really change. I really wanted to capture that moment. He wanted to capture the moment of like, okay, I'm here. And also to help distract me too. But he said, your eyes were just, I looked at the photo, and I still have it. And I was like, you're right. I mean, if you see this photo, it's a little bit haunting because my eyes look really deeply set. They look like they saw death. Oh my God. And so that experience changed me from that point onward. Mm. And then the first real death I experienced was a couple of years later. It was my grandfather. Mm. And when it was announced that he had died, I was strangely calm about it. Mm. I felt like I really understood death from a young age. And in fact, at his wake, when his body laid out, I was really comfortable touching him and trying to hold his hand, much to my older relatives.
It wasn't something that felt scary to you as a child, yeah.
And in fact, as a teenager, as I started to evolve, whenever there was a funeral that my mother or granny were going to, can I come? I wanted to be around death. There's something around me that was compelled. So I went to lots of wakes and funerals when I was a teenager, often to people I wasn't even close to, but my granny was, or my mother was. And I felt like I want to view the practice of death. I want to be around it. I want to see people who are deceased. But it wasn't in a morbid, like, I'm a goth and I want, It was just like I wanted to be in those spaces. I wanted to be around this great taboo called death. Mm. But also probably because my formative experiences too, I felt there was a weight to it that was with me. I felt like I needed to be present in those sort of situations. Mm. As a teenager too, my best friend, her father was dying of cancer. And I journeyed with her through the whole time that she was going through that. And, you know, as a 15, 16 year old, 17 year old, like, that's pretty big. And
it's huge, yeah.
Felt like I was able to hold space for that too as a young person.
Well, so you were starting to hold space for people in death and dying even as a teenager.
Yes. And then and also my parents have always done compassion work. They're very humanitarian in that sense. Mm. And around that time too, they were going to old folks' homes to visit people who didn't have any relatives who would visit them, you know, lonely but old people. And my parents are musicians. And so they would, you know, play songs and sing. And I would accompany them. I had my keyboard sometimes and I would play along and I'd be there too. And I would visit with them. And I always felt so much like it was difficult for me. I always have to nip off to the bathroom and just cry my eyes out because I just felt so much compassion for these people who were just like alone and at end of life. And I was just like, oh, it really like just pulled at my heart so much. So I've always been around the role without even knowing what the role was.
Would you mind, Tree, if I asked you about how you work with families or with individuals when they're dying, like what that process is and what the support is that you provide, and at what point often you would meet somebody who contacted you for
for this work? I'm just absolutely fascinated.
Yeah, it's always very different. And maybe I'll first tell you how I started the role.
Yeah,
like,
please.
The epiphany. There was like all these synchronistic events of always being there when people are in crisis, near to death, being there, helping them breathe through the pain, calling the ambulance, doing CPR. And like it kept happening up until the point where there was one profound time, and it was like here in London, and I was walking down Broadway Market, and a man collapsed in my arms, and he was having a massive cardiac arrest. Wow. And we tried desperately to save him, and we were doing CPR, and it was outside of a clinic, so someone came by with a defibrillator as well, trying to revive him. And I just had a real feeling like this guy is slipping. And yeah. His head was in my lap and I was holding his hand. And as we were all working on him, I was like, I need to give this guy some love and a soothing presence.
Yeah.
So I was just saying the words, you're not alone. You're not alone. It's okay. You know, just giving comforting words, you know, just jumped into that role. And sadly, this man passed and I really experienced his whole transition, everything, his
God,
final breath.
Wow.
His eyes were wide open, looking up into the sky, and just tears were streaming down his face. It always makes me think, like, what did he see? You know, like he went into this peace and then the last breath. And so from that moment, you know, I was like, this is crazy. This kind of stuff follows me through, like, since I was young, right? And I'm getting a complex here. So I decided to go to bed and ask my dreams, can you just help me out? Like sleep on it, right? Ask your dreams, show me something. So when I was waking up, I had like a quick succession of dreams of all the times in my life where I had these uncanny experiences with strangers and always there at these scary moments of death for people, like giving them emotional comfort. And I just woke up with like a eureka moment. I was like, that's what I'm meant to be doing. And then I was like, hang on a minute. Like, it's not a paramedic, but it's like this emotional support for people scared of death and like in crisis. So I went on to Google and Googled a series of words, emotional support at death, because that was the only thing I could think of what I'm actually offering to the situation. And literally like one of the first pages I saw was a death doulas.
Wow.
And it was a training for the certification. I went to the website, read, and I went, that's me. That's what I've been doing. And I signed up straight away, and the rest is history. I got my doula training and then began to work with people.
And how long ago was that?
So that would have been, when did that, so I'm nearly 50, so this is my early 40s.
Wow, for 10 years you've been doing this work.
For kind of close to that, yeah. About maybe 8 or something like that. So it was big shifts happened to me in 2012. I remember like when I was 40, it was like, whoa, I'm stepping out of service to people in so many different ways. But yeah, so that the rest is history. And how I help people, it's always different because everyone's death is different and everyone's journey is different.
Yeah.
So some folks, I'm there for like maybe one session because they're afraid. And so I help a lot with death phobia and help people to remove their fear of death and dying. For other folks, it's being there through the practical questions. Like I've been a celebrant at funerals and have spoken at funerals. I've helped arrange memorials and funerals. Mm. So I've done practical stuff. Mm. I've done emotional support for family members who are losing someone.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I get a lot of that where I help people with their anticipatory grief, or I've did a lot of work during COVID because a lot of people lost their loved ones to COVID and couldn't see them.
Oh, terrible.
So they had extreme, like they didn't have closure.
Mm.
So I did a lot of sessions around closure and bereavement and to help people feel that. And I've helped with death, you know, deathbed vigiling for people, helping to release their loved ones.
Mm.
Sometimes we keep them tethered here because we have unfinished business. So I've helped quite a few people with their unfinished business in terms of their interpersonal relationships.
And do some people or families also want you to be there to attend the deaths of
their loved ones as well.
It's really different. Yeah. And it's the end of life is so bespoke. It's so unpredictable, yeah. but it's also deeply personal.
Yeah.
And the person who is dying and the family, but predominantly the person who's dying, has agency yeah. of their wishes.
Yeah.
And sometimes people just want to be alone.
Yeah.
They don't want to have people around. Mm-hmm. I've done a lot of deathbed vigiling like via technology, which is so wild.
Yeah,
but it's equally as powerful.
Yeah, yeah,
so they're in the room helping and supporting, lighting a candle and guiding through meditations and helping through that a lot.
Mm.
On phone calls, on Zoom calls, on Skype, that's happened quite a bit. I've been there for people in the hour before death, the moments before death, with some guiding help as well. Because I do get a lot of phone calls around, like, because when people are actively dying in the 3 days, sometimes mystical things can happen and there can be, you know, strange occurrences. So I'll get phone calls about those sometimes too, about people's deathbed visions and their nightmares, and you know, there's a lot sometimes people can experience.
And do you feel that the experience or the kind of innate way in which you've been able to kind of build this kind of relationship with death and dying, have you been able to use some of those tools and that experience for yourself with the experience of loss personally? Have you been able to draw, you know, reach for those?
Absolutely. My sister died 3 months ago, and in the beginning of her journey, it was really intense. It was very quick, 8 months from the time she got her prognosis to the time she passed. And as soon as I, you know, got news of that, I knew that, you know, here I am stepping into this role for my own family. And it was a very challenging situation because my sister didn't want anyone around, and she isolated herself through her illness and through her journey towards death. And this was very challenging because as a death doula, you think, oh, I know all the ins and outs of death. Here it is, my own family members. I can be a superhero and come and help. But then I was faced with this challenge that my sister just didn't want anyone around. She didn't want to talk to anyone, and this was really challenging. And I had to sit with that to respect her personal choices at end of life. And she had agency, and she wanted to be alone. And this was so deeply unsettling and difficult. So for me, it was the biggest challenge as a death doula to respect her wishes. And I had to immediately go into grief. I was grieving and grieving, and I had to accept the possibility that I might never see my sister ever again. And I need to sit with that reality. And I needed to hold my entire family and give them that message too. Because she literally was only talking, she was talking to her husband, and her husband was talking to me. And then he didn't want everyone calling him. So I was talking to my entire family, my elderly parents included. And so it was a really challenging time because my parents all of a sudden are in a position of helplessness. They couldn't reach out. She didn't want to talk to anyone. And so it was so challenging to hold everybody in that. So she's in Canada. And so what ended up happening was I did all my loving things vicariously through her partner. And I did things like sent care packages, really practical things, you know. Let's send some, you know, beautiful salon style wigs for her and cozy, comfy clothes. And that will get to her. She'll know I love her. She knows I love her and I care from afar. She had to go through her own thing. She wanted to go through it this way. The wonderful thing, though, that ended up happening was at one point, it was about a month before she died, she felt open to receiving a visit. And so she finally talked to my mother on the phone. And so plans were made for my parents to go and visit her. which was a real great, to me, I'm like, that's all I want. Like, I just, that to me, that's great.
Yeah.
If I don't, I mean, I will try. So I was planning to get there too. But what ended up happening, so it was around June 19th. It was just before the solstice. And they visited her. And, you know, we weren't really told just how much she was fading and how much she was ravaged. And so, and I understand because her partner was, you know, probably there's a lot to take in. So there was a lot of trying to focus on the positive and not wanting to announce the little wins and not, you know, announce just how she was really slipping. So my parents showed up and walked into the room and obviously were floored because they didn't see their daughter. And but my parents are amazing. And they just moved into loving, holding, caring, beautiful, loving mode for her. And they just held her and like loved her and they were there. And like literally within hours, she looked at my mom and said, "It's not going to be long now, Mom." And within, right after that, she just started to slip and they had to get her to the hospital. She was like hanging on. She's hanging on. As soon as my parents arrived, she started to surrender. And that's when everyone started to fly in because we got news that she's been admitted to hospital. And so I'm scrambling to get onto a plane. Okay, I got to get over, And I was, you know, bought the plane tickets. Of course, the nearest flight I could get was the next day. Being where I am, I'm far away, I'm abroad. So getting that all in order. And then as I'm packing, getting all it all in order, you know, I get the phone call and it's like, she's not going to make it through the night, the doctors say. So and I'm just like, oh my God, I'm not going to make it. I'm not going to be there. I got to get there. And then I was just told, like, you should say your words now over the phone because she's really slipping. And she's kind of like not here, like she's, you know. So I'm on the phone giving her my words of whatever's just coming out from the well of my heart, which is I love you forever and we're always together. We're always going to be connected, you know, just I love you forever and all the beautiful words. And I could hear her. I could hear her trying to, I could hear her trying to make words. I could, the tone of her voice, she couldn't speak, but it was just like a moaning. And I knew she heard me when I got off. My mom said, she heard you, her eyes opened, and she's been slipped under for a long time, like for hours. So she really heard you, Tree. She heard you. And that felt profound. It felt so weird. Like, you know, I feel like I'm in one of those cliche movies right now where, you know, I'm like, oh my God, am I going to win the best Oscar award for the most compelling moment of death on the telephone or something? It was really like, I can't believe this is happening kind of moments. And then I was just like, oh my God, okay, I need to get there. I need to get there. And this was the trippiest thing. So as I had to book a hotel to stay in a hotel. So the next morning I'm on an early flight.
So this is when you were still in the UK.
I'm still in the UK. I'm online looking for hotels around Heathrow. And I see this one hotel and it was so bizarre, but I felt my sister right there saying, that's the one, that's a hotel. Like it was almost like she was already in the other realms. She was very strong there in my sphere. So I clicked it and I'm going through the rooms and she's like, that room there. I'm like, this is so trippy. I'm going to listen to her. That is a very expensive room, but I'm going to book it anyway. And I'm like, maybe there's a reason. I don't know. I just felt like, okay, I'm listening. And my partner and I get in the cab. We rush to the hotel. We're in the hotel. We go to sleep, ready to take our early flight. I'm sleeping. And in the middle of the night, I'm woken up and I'm woken up in that sleep paralysis state. So this is the liminal threshold state I was describing at the beginning of our conversation. And in sleep paralysis, you are conscious, totally conscious, but you're kind of like in between a dream, in between reality. In esoteric thought, you are in like the astral plane or the interdimensional plane, just on the other, it's beyond the veil. And in this moment, laying in the bed of this hotel room, I'm like, all of a sudden, it's so bizarre, but this cat comes jumping out of nowhere onto the bed. Of course, this is all in this liminal threshold state. And the cat starts doing this purr paw thing with the duvet, like pulling up the duvet. Like, you know, when cats do that to try to get your attention and wake you up. And of course, my first reaction, because I'm totally conscious, as we are conscious right now, my first reaction, like, what? There's a cat in the room. How'd the cat get in the room? Like, startled, absolutely startled. Then the coin drops, and I had this strong feeling and presence of, it was my sister, like, as a cat. I know it sounds bonkers, but then I just went, oh, my God. And I was just like, I love you, I love you, I love you forever. I'm here. And I know this sounds mad, but I felt like she was telepathically speaking to me through, like, as this cat, and said, take care of my son. Be there for my son. And my wonderful nephew, who's just an amazing, amazing person, who, by the way, would have recurring experiences growing up, waking up in the middle of the night going, oh my God, mom's going to die. And just run to the room and have a cuddle with her mom. So, like, very unusual sensing there on his part. And I said, of course I will. Oh, well, I will be there. I will be there for him. And the experience dissolved. I woke up, I was sobbing, and I thought, I got a text straight away. Texted my youngest sister, my mom, both of them at the same time with the experience. And I felt like I need to send this. And I also need proof that it happened in the time. Yeah. And went back into sleep. And then the next morning, woke up, my partner and I get in the cab, get to the airport. We're about to check in. And I get a phone call. And my sister passed in the night. She passed at 12:45. And I'm sitting there doing the maths, and I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, that's the time I had. That's the exact time. Check the texts. That's when I had this experience of her coming through as, like, this cat in this strange liminal experience of the dreaming. And my younger sister was crying on the phone saying, you're not going to believe this last thing I whispered in her ear. So everyone was there except me. Jeez. Was the last thing she whispered into my sister's ear was, go find Tree. Go find her. She's trying to reach you. Find her in the dreams. Go find her in the dreams. And she gave that request to my dying sister, and she did it. She came through, and we were both crying but laughing, and it just brought so much closure. So even though I couldn't physically be there, like, she came through in this other way. Like, it was just phenomenal. Like, it was up there with one of the most profound experiences of my life. Mm-hmm. And it brought immense closure. Mm-hmm. And I got there. I had the beautiful, profound experience, though, of being able to be with my deceased sister. Mm-hmm. So the funeral home held her there, and we put wildflowers all over her body, and my entire family was in the room, and we just held her and hugged her and kissed her and wailed and cried over her. And it was an amazing experience as a family to just cathartically release as a family together over our beautiful sister and daughter, and just honor her, you know. And it was so healing for my whole family, brothers crying, dad crying, everyone, just to mourn. And just immensely, it was so incredible. It was magic. And, you know, the day after everyone settled, my father and I were out on a walk, and we were really crying. He was speaking a lot about life, and he's a very beautiful man, very compassionate, and very easy to express emotions. And he was weeping. And as that moment was happening, all of a sudden, this bright green flying creature came flying into us and then flying outwards. And we were like, what was that? It, like, brought us into, like, the present moment. And it looked like a tropical bird. It was lime green and, like, amazing. And I was like, that was like a butterfly or something, because it was flying kind of erratically. And it flew off and it lifted us. And my dad was like, oh, it's spirit. You know, like, he felt like it was, you know, it was her, she was coming through in this beautiful way. And so we went back and told everyone at, you know, all the family members back at the Airbnb. And as more family ascended, my great niece comes and she shows up and she's got this really interesting tattoo on her. I'm like, it's the butterfly that we've seen. Yeah. And I said, oh my God. I was like, Dad, look, it's the butterfly we saw, because it had really specific long tail with like these eye marks and stuff on it. Like it was wild and it was bright green. And she's like, oh, that's not a butterfly. That's a Luna moth. And I'm like, what's Luna moth? And she's like, Luna moth is a really amazing moth that only lives for 1 week. And you saw one? Yes, you saw one yesterday. And we were like, yeah, we saw one. We felt like it was a beautiful mystical experience. Mm-hmm. And she's like, wow, because it, if you see one, it's considered a mystical experience, because it is a symbol of the brevity of life, the rebirth and the transformation.
Oh my God, Trey, I got goosebumps.
Yeah, and we were like, oh my God, that's amazing. And then, so when it came time to choose her urn, because she was then cremated, we were at the funeral home and there's all of these urns, and we looked, and I was there with her, my sister's husband, and we looked. And I went, it's that one. It was one with all this butterfly on it. So we're like, that's the one. And we chose that. We chose that for her. And we really worked around the theme of the Luna moth and transformation for her eulogy. And so I brought that into the eulogy. But there's been so many synchronistic experiences since her death that have made me just feel like, you know, that you can't make this stuff up, including the song that I sang at my sister's funeral during the moment of silence. It was a song, I wasn't preparing to sing a song at her funeral, and it just came out. Like, it was just all of a sudden this sound
came through. Yeah,
it just came through. It was a song from The Unforgettable Fire, from a U2 U2 album from 1987 or 86. It just came to me and I was just saying the song, which helped release people into tears. And And then, no joke, but a week later, I was back in the UK holding space for a dreaming retreat in Wales. And the man that owned the land, this beautiful land in Snowdonia, came down as we're all at dinner, all the retreat members, and I'm there to facilitate the retreat. He came in just to give, hey, welcome to my land, and here's the story of my land. And he tells us the story. And the story of his land was how he manifested this land, because he really wanted it, but he was broke. And so on the summer solstice of 1986, he decided to do this ritual to help bring this land into his possession. And he said, and at the end of, you know, my ritual, I sang this song. And he starts singing the same song that I sang at my sister's funeral. He's like, sleep, sleep tonight, and may your dreams be realized. Those are just the first few lyrics of the song. And we all just were gobsmacked, because I had posted my eulogy and song on my Instagram. So a lot of the people who were at the retreat had seen that.
Because you also, am I right, Drew, that you were the celebrant for your
sister, my sister's funeral.
Sister. Yeah. Oh, God.
So when he started singing that, I felt her there.
Yeah.
And the synchronicities haven't stopped. So there are these things that happen in life that feel very mystical. But I would say to anyone listening, don't shrug them off. Mm. Allow those uncanny experiences. Hold space for your heart and your love for your deceased loved one. Mm. Let it heal you. Let it bring peace. Let it bring closure. Let it bring joy. Mm. Because I think they're there. They happen to hold you. And so don't shrug them off as like, oh, it's just weird coincidence. Mm. Like, lean into it with love and just feel the moment, because they're so special and they can happen a lot after someone dies.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince.
Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
You know, Tree, what you were just saying then about and what you said to your sister, that I love you forever, that is exactly what I was saying to my mum when she died. And it was also the only two words that she could say at the end of her life was love forever, because her cancer was in the speech and language centres of her brain, and it completely destroyed her ability to form coherent language, which was particularly cool because my mum's one of her greatest gifts was her ability to communicate, you know, with passion and precision and the most incredible, you know, articulate emotional intelligence. But in the end of her life, the only two words that she could say together was love forever.
That's amazing.
The only two words that she could say was like everything else just became distilled down to those two words, and that's all she would just say. Love forever. Love forever. And so on her gravestone, those are the two words. I'll show you a picture.
That's so powerful. And those words can stay with you, and you can pass those words down to your children.
No, exactly. And you know, Tree, what you said this earlier, but you know, the truly, you know, our experiences of death are outlived by the experience of love. That, you know, love outlives death is what I, you know, love is the thing that lasts forever. And, you know, when you've, you know, there may be people listening to this podcast who are going through, who have just been through a bereavement or are, you know, caring for somebody who's terminally ill. And, you know, I would just say that the experience of living with somebody through death, through dying and death, as you've just described, Tree, is when it comes down to it, is actually just the most intensely distilled, profound experience of love, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and once I realised that, you know, I realised that actually grief is not something to be scared of. You know, if you reframe,
yes,
all of those like howling fucking winds of sadness that rage through you after somebody you love so much has died, if you just reframe those as love, and those, it's like the wild winds of love, then it's, you can hold it in a different way.
It's so, you know, true. Yes. Mm. Really at the core of that grief is beautiful, beautiful love. And it, that grief will always be there. If you imagine it like a little ball, that grief, but in the center of it is a glowing hot love. And you grow around that grief. So grief and bereavement is not a linear thing. It's not like, oh, I'm going to be better in 3 weeks or in 5 years, I'll be better. It's not linear. You grow around your grief. So if you lean into the core of the grief, into the love, crack it open like a Kinder egg or something, and just know when that wave of sorrow or sadness comes, just let it wash onto you. Let it wash over you. Let the wave wash over you. And don't resist it. Just feel it. And as you feel it and you let your body express and cry and do what it needs to do, it cracks your heart open more and it connects you more to them. Yeah. To have shared experiences, I mean, it's fresh for me. My sister's only 3 months past. So the timing of this is very unique in that we can mirror back to each other our own shared experiences. Interesting how, like, you were with your mom holding space as she passed. My mom was there holding my sister. She was the one there with her hand on my sister's heart. And my mom said, you know, I was here and brought her into the world. It's me, I'm here helping her leave the world. And so, you know, I'm like, Mom, yes, you were the one who, it needed to be you. It needed to be you who was there doing that work. So
mother's love, the mother's love knows no bounds.
Exactly. And so what an honor for her to be on both ends of that journey.
True.
It's just so, wow, you know. And her hand was on her heart. So intuitively, she said, I felt like my hand needed to be there. So that connection again, you know, that little place of the portal of connection. So,
well, thank you so much for, you know, sharing that story with us, because it's very, very, very recent, that loss. And to be honest, I couldn't even find words for what I had been through, you know, for many, 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 many months after. So it's a real gift for people, you know, and I know there are lots of people who follow this podcast who, you know, are leaning into it because we talk about, you know, a lot of the big things that don't get talked about enough, I don't think. And so having that insight from you at this, you know, in these very, very hyper real, vivid, raw, early stages of loss is just, it provides a torchlight in what can feel like complete darkness for some people. So I just, on behalf of myself and my listeners, Tree, thank you for that.
Hey, it's a pleasure. Yeah. And I hope, you know, if it brings light to anyone who's listening.
Well,
I'm so grateful.
I have no doubt about that. Now, obviously, I just want to sit here with you till 3 a.m. all night. But I'm going to try and resist my urge to move on to all other things. But listen, I hope this is the first of many more times and conversations we will have, Tree. But so as we move into the end of this unbelievably special time we've had with you, I just want to ask you, Tree, what does courage feel like?
That's a good question. Courage is not what you would think, maybe, what society teaches you courage is. You know, when you think of the word courage, you think of like these warriors or these, you know, a very masculine archetype of armor or knights or courage. But I think courage, real courage, comes from the deep stillness of knowing who you are. And it's know thyself. And true strength and true courage is being able to sit in the midst of a storm or a social situation that feels out of your league or any kind of situation that feels challenging, and just to be able to pull into yourself and go, there I am. I'm rooted here and I know who I am. I'm all good. And it's almost like understanding that you have all those reserves within you and being able to access it. So it's not an external thing, it's an internal process. And then as you sit in that courage or strength and it reverberates outwards, it just brings a peace around you. And I think that's what you access when you hold space for someone who's dying or who's really grieving, is just to, you know, to center into that. And a lot of the times it's not having words to try to fix somebody.
Yeah.
It's okay. It's all right. It's just the presence of being and the presence of that inner strength or that courage. People feel it. It's palpable. And that's what I think real courage is.
Beautiful answer. Satri, if there's one person in the world that you'd like to be proud of you, they could be living or they could also have died, who would that be?
I mean, the first thing that popped into my head were, of course, my parents.
Yeah.
I mean, that was my, parents, partner, but it was like, I mean, parents, mom, you know, like, it's funny what it comes down to. And going back to that near-death experience when I was a child, it was like the first people I felt worried for were my parents.
Yeah.
My parents, all of our parents are, you know, they're huge influence on us in many ways, but I would say it would be my parents. And I really hope that I do make them proud in the ways that I hope I do make them proud, you know. So Mom and Dad, if you're listening, I love you, and I hope I've made you proud.
Beautiful answer. Okay, so Tree, in true human form, every episode we ask our guest to dedicate our conversation to a song, so we'll play out with a song. And so before we say goodbye, you are incredible. This has been one of my most favourite times in conversation. And I really, really mean it. It's like, I know this is what you do, what you live and breathe every single day, but for so many people who are struggling to find any, who feel their experiences of loss or anticipatory loss or grief or feel so pathless, you have just provided so much colour and comfort and just reassurance, and in the most deeply wonderful way, of something which is so often just cast into the shadows as being a scary, awful thing that we mustn't look at. And you, through you looking at it, you know, in the way that you do, it's a real gift, Tree. So I just wanted to say personally, I mean, I followed your work for a long time because of my own personal experience with these things, and it's done that for me, and I'm sure it has for many other people. And if anyone's listening who would like to find out more about Tree's work, then you can go and find her on her social media page, which is
Tree_Carr. Although there's an imposter out there at the moment that we're
trying to... Oh, no, we don't want them.
That happens sometimes, right? Where someone else, they put two underscores, so it looks like me.
Not two underscores.
And you know what they're doing? They're messaging people, trying to get money out of them for services. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I know. We got to shut
them
down.
Don't want those naughty buggers. No,
yeah, we got to shut them down.
Tree_Carr.
I'm the _Carr. I'm the original gangster. So.
Amazing. All right, Tree, so what song are we going to play out with today?
It's got to be the song I sang at my sister's funeral. And the song that the man at the retreat center just busted out. The song of synchronicity. This is by U2 off their Unforgettable Fire album. And it's called MLK.
Here we have it. MLK by U2. Tree, we fucking love you.
Love you so much.
Sleep tonight and may your dreams be realized. If the thunder cloud passes rain, so
thank you all so much for listening. If you'd like to rate, review and subscribe to us on your podcast app, then please do. And you know the score, 5 stars, please. If you'd like to come and say hello on Instagram, then you can find me and all things human podcast related at This Is Jess Mills. This podcast was created and hosted by me, Jess Mills, with creative co-production by Bonnie Tyburn and produced by Joel Porter at ...
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.